This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
I'm Aideen Finnegan, and this is In the News from the Irish Times. Today, a verdict of unlawful killing, 43 years pursuing the truth of the Stardust fire. It took just 9 minutes for the blaze to engulf the Artain ballroom in the early hours of Valentine's Day 1981. 48 young people lost their lives in what remains the deadliest fire in the history of the state. And yet, their families were left battling for decades for an inquest that wouldn't just record a medical cause of death, but forensically interrogate what happened that night. Yesterday, a jury returned a verdict of unlawful killing for each of the 48 victims. Social affairs correspondent Kitty Holland was in the courtroom.
It's absolutely huge, momentous day. I mean, when the jury returned, first of all, said that they had the same verdict for all 48 dead, that was a huge, you could hear the sigh of relief that everyone was going to get the same verdict, that there would no one be left out of the verdict. And then when they returned the unlawful killing verdict, the cheer was absolutely enormous. People were hugging and crying. There was an audible people sobbing and hugging, and particularly running over to some of the very elderly parents who were there.
The coroner was asking the jury, could they say when the fire started, what part of the ballroom it started in? Can you explain a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, as well as returning verdicts in respect of each of the 48 dead, the jury was tasked with establishing facts around the circumstances of the fire. And what they established, and for the first time ever since the Stardust fire happened 43 years ago, they said that the fire started in a hot press and that it was caused by an electrical fault in the hot press. They also said that the doors were obstructed, and all the factors that they had been speaking about over the 43 years were true, did happen, and did contribute to the huge death toll that we all know about.
Were people surprised at how far the jury went? Did you get that sense from being in the room?
I think they were relieved. I think, you know, it was absolutely packed. You know, the legal teams all had to give up their seats because there were hundreds of family members. Everyone was feeling very extremely tense, extremely nervous, feeling kind of sick, you know, because the verdict they wanted was unlawful killing, and this was the last throw of the dice. This was the last chance for them. You know, the jury took so long to deliberate. They couldn't return unanimous verdicts. In the end, they had to go majority verdicts. They got there in the end, and families were all in tears. The legal teams were all in tears. It was just a moment of just exhalation and relief. Just 43 years of hurt, I think, come to an end, you know.
Following the verdict, the families walked to the tune of You'll Never Walk Alone towards the Garden of Remembrance on Dublin's Parnell Square. It was there they addressed the public.
Hi, my name is Lisa Lawler. I lost both of my parents in the Stardust tragedy. It's been a battle.
How are you feeling today after that verdict?
I'm honoured to be here for the verdict, and I'm feeling very elated. I have to say I'm very, very happy that this verdict has been reached after 43 years. I feel like part of me has been healed today.
Now that the inquest is over, what can you say about the whole process? I mean, were you happy with it?
I was very happy with it, very thankful to the legal team, very thankful to the press, to the media, to the coroner, and very thankful to everybody who's helped us and who's brought us this far. It was hard work. You know, it was hard work coming in, it was hard work listening to how my parents died, but thank God we've got there.
I'm Alison Croker. I'm the little sister of Jacqueline Croker, who was victim number 3 for 43 years.
Tell me about her.
So Jackie was the oldest of our family. Jackie went to work to hand up money in the house because things were hard. She played darts. She's still fondly remembered by everybody who knew her. At the age of 12, I was woken at 7 o'clock in the morning because I shared a bedroom with Jackie, to be asked what clothes had she got on her, because she had a long white coat on, so they didn't know what she had on underneath it. What clothes had she got on her? what underwear had she got on so that they could identify her at the age of 12. And then when I went to the church on the Tuesday evening for the receiving of the remains, there was my sister, there was my football coach, Julie MacDonald, there was Caroline Carey, who I knew from Irish Dancing, and then my sister's friend were the four coffins in our church. I was taken out of the church and had to be brought home and sedated. So to say you had a massive impact on my life is an understatement. I have three children. They have to have their location turned on Snapchat so I can check where they are, even if they're in the same house as me.
Because you're worried, that anxiety.
Yeah. My sister went out to play darts, decided on her way home, the doors were still open in the Stardust. Ah, feck it, I'll go in. Paula's dancing. Paula lived on our road. All the teenagers off our road were in the Stardust. Jackie went in, 12:15. 2 hours later, she was gone. We should have had justice 40 years ago, never mind 43 years after the disaster. I feel vindicated, I do. But I also feel sad, in a way, that so many people that stood here today have had to lose our lives fighting for justice for our loved ones. And that's the way I feel.
Jimmy Fitzpatrick is my name.
Jimmy, you're a survivor of the Stardust fire.
Yeah, I was the longest in hospital and the worst one to survive the fire. And thankfully, I'm here today to see justice for the 48.
Were you rescued or did you manage to get out?
I got out. I got into the hallway, was 2 feet from the door, went back in for two girls that I knew. And then I got them into the passageway where everyone was being carried out, and then I tripped over either a handbag or a coat. To this day, I can't really understand what it was, but I hit the ground and then the lights went out and then I got trampled and I was crawling on my arms and hands to get out and realised I was going the wrong way. I was on the wooden floor. I realised I'm back on the dance floor. We eventually got to a door that was being kicked and I jumped up and helped kick that door and got out that way. And that's how I survived, thankfully.
Did you know what had happened, or had you always wondered? Was there answers given in the inquest that you had always questioned?
No. Look, we knew, you know, from day one that like all the doors were chained. There was carpet tiles on the walls. There was steel plates on the windows of the toilets. Like the place was, it was just boxed. You know, we knew that this is all wrong. The 43 years of just consistent governments kicking the can down the road, you know, and passing the baton on to whoever's next. And now we finally have sat there and the families can say, thank God, we've now seen justice for our loved ones. These families shouldn't have to wait that long. You know, really, it's that in itself is a tragedy.
I'm Samantha Mangan. Helena was my mother. She was only 22 years of age and I was only 4.5 when she perished in that fire. She went out to have a night of fun, as I say, fun, love and danced with her partner, John Stowe, who also died that night, and she never came home. I woke up that morning, we still lived at home, in the family home, we had bunk beds, she slept on the top bunk, I slept on the bottom bunk, and I never forget, I woke up that morning, I climbed up and she wasn't in her bed. And it was a bit strange, because she normally, I don't, especially after being out, I would wake her up. She wasn't there that night. I went down the stairs and all I remember for days is people coming in and out of the house, strange people, people I didn't know, but never my mother. She never came home. I've been left wondering for 43 years what happened to her that night.
I mean, as satisfied as I'm sure you are with the results, it doesn't bring your mum back. And I'm wondering, will you get the relief that maybe you were hoping from today?
Well, I got justice, and for me, I found out exactly what happened and what went on in that night. The fire, the way the building was built, the lack of respect, that, you know, but I got the truth at the end of the day. For me, that's why I sat there through the court, so I could move on and I can be a better mum to my kids, give the kids, my five children, the mother that they deserve, the mother that I never had. And that was my main aim at the end of this, so I could fix me to be a better man for them as well. It's getting justice for my mum, who I never got to share my life with.
Coming up,
Saoirse Pollock speaks to Kitty Holland about why it took so long for the families to get answers.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Kitty, the Stardust Inquiry ran for an entire year. Can you remind us why this inquiry was considered necessary?
Sure, yeah. I mean, as most people or many people will know, there was a tribunal set up in 1981, which was chaired by Mr. Justice Ronan Keane, and that sat for 122 days, the same number of days as these inquests have sat, kind of interestingly. And that was tasked with primarily finding the cause of the fire and making of the recommendations. That found that the most probable cause of the fire was arson.
Okay.
That was extremely upsetting to the families. And it was a kind of bizarre finding in many ways, because the Justice Keane in his report said that there was no evidence to show that to support a finding of arson. Mm. But having eliminated all the other possible causes, the most probable cause was arson. So it was a really kind of convoluted finding, and one that hugely upset the families, because it besmirched the children who were there and the community in general. So that was very painful. Then there were inquests held the following year, 1982, and they lasted about 10 or 15 minutes each and just returned medical causes of death. And they were kind of quite perfunctory. Again, the families found them quite unsatisfactory, but they had to be done for the death certs. Mm. And then there was a long campaign by a handful of families, really, the Barretts, who lost Michael, who was 17, and the Keegans, who lost Mary and Martina, who were 19 and 16. And they campaigned and campaigned and campaigned for a review of the evidence. And there were two held, 2008, and that was led by a barrister at the time, now a judge, Paul Coffey, who found that the arson finding should be removed from the public record. And that was done by the Oireachtas in 2009. And that left no cause for the fire. The families continued to campaign looking for the truth, and they another review was headed up by Mr. Justice McCartan, and he found no need for another investigation. What really changed it was a couple of families thought they would approach Lynn Boylan, who was an MEP at the time, and where they should go to Europe and get outside, you know, intervention from outside. And they, through that process, met the solicitor, Dara Macken, who is kind of the hero of the piece, and certainly the families feel he's their absolute saviour.
A number of strands that we say are absolutely critical to the a new inquest. Firstly, the developments in the science.
He saw, I think, because he was from Belfast, and he saw how the legacy inquests there into contested deaths, how inquests could be used to find the truth.
This is Ireland's greatest atrocity. It can never be accepted, and it isn't acceptable that the events of that night go unanswered and unaddressed.
He submitted an application to the then Attorney General, Seamus Wolfe, in 2019, and they engaged, crucially, the European Convention of Human Rights. And that states that when Article 2 of the European Convention of Human Rights is engaged, that the circumstances around the death have to be investigated as well. And that was not done in the original inquests. And Seamus Wolfe agreed, and he granted that these inquests should be held, directed that these inquests should be held, because there was an insufficiency of investigation into the surrounding circumstances of the fire at the original inquests. And that is how we got to this.
It's a great overview, Kitty. Thanks a million. So this was the format of the inquiry. Evidence was heard by a jury of 15 people sitting 4 days a week. 373 witnesses were called, including eyewitnesses, family members of victims and people involved in Stardust, like the forum manager, Eamon Butterley, forensic experts, fire experts and so on. There have been various breaks and delays, but still, that's a lot of testimony and a lot of evidence. It's a challenge to sum it all up. But could you try and give us a rundown of the main points that the jury will have been considering when coming to their verdict?
Well, yeah, as you say, 373 witnesses. A lot of them were deceased, so it was read into the record, their evidence from the Keane Tribunal in 1981. I mean, a lot of the evidence had already been heard, but it was being looked at through this fresh prism of the European Convention of Human Rights. And so the main things that the jury has been looking at are if they can establish the cause of the fire, the location of the cause of the fire, why it spread so rapidly. This fire started, was first seen inside the venue at 1:41 a.m. 9 minutes later, the whole venue, which held 1,500 people, was engulfed in flames and the fire was powering through the roof. So people had 2 or 3 minutes to get out. Firemen said it was the fastest, most rapid conflagration of fire they'd ever seen. It was so the jury had to look at why it spread so fast. Were there obstacles to the young people getting out? And then look at the kind of the causes of death for each individual. So there were 48 verdicts returned, one for each of the deceased. So they're having to look at a huge, huge volume of evidence. And I suppose the key things were that we heard the most likely location they were looking at in terms of where the fire started was in a hot press where there was faulty wiring that was established and that the fire possibly started there and went up into the roof space and over the venue and then melted material that was in the roof space, which then dripped down onto a seat, which is where the fire was first seen. The key factor in the rapid spread of the fire was these carpet tiles, which we heard a lot about over the years and we heard again at the inquests. There were nearly 3,000 of these carpet tiles used to line the internal walls. They were bought at a reduced price from an English supplier and they did not meet fire requirements that had been stipulated by the chief fire officer at the time. And what happened with the inquest heard was that when that tiny flame started or was first seen on a seat, which was made from polyurethane foam and PVC coating, which was itself flammable, it might have gone out or not have got out of control, but the heat against the carpet tiles lit the carpet tile. That drove heat up, which lit the carpet tiles up the way. There was a low roof over the alcove where the fire was first seen. So the gases that were being emitted by the seats and the carpet tile then started building down and the air itself became flammable. So the air within the stardust became flammable and the fumes were toxic. It was cyanide and carbon monoxide, which was eating up the oxygen. So people couldn't breathe. So as the fire grew, it was eating more of the oxygen. The lights failed within 2 or 3 minutes. We heard there were chains draped over the exit doors. There were 6 exit doors, which would have been plenty for the people to get out if they had been properly accessible. And the chains impeded people's access. And there were obstructions then with chairs stacked in front of exit doors. There was a bottle skip in front of another exit door. Doors seemed to have jammed once they did get open. We heard horrendous stories of piles up at doors, people getting trampled, people going upstairs to try and get out, people going into the toilets to try and thinking they could escape through the windows. But 6 weeks before the fire, the management had decided to seal the windows shut in the toilets with steel plates because people were handing alcohol through. So people were trapped in the toilets. So everything that could go wrong went wrong on the night. Added to that, staff were not trained in fire evacuation procedures. So staff as well were just trying to save themselves. So there's no one in charge. And by the time the first fire brigade arrived at 6 minutes after the 999 call, first 999 call at 1:43 a.m. And by then, the fire was almost past its peak. So it was an incredibly fast moving fire. In many ways, it's incredible. Maybe 200 people weren't killed. In fact, one of the doorman's evidence, a deceased doorman at the inquest, was said that in his opinion, things worked well on the night and that only 48 people were killed. So it was a shattering, shattering disaster. And in many ways, when you look at how badly built and how uncompliant it was with the fire safety standards at the time, which were there, you know, Eamon Bushley tried to argue that there were no standards. Mm-hmm. It's it was almost waiting to happen. You know, the Stardust opened in March 1978, and it's almost incredible there wasn't a fire until 1981.
There were a number of different verdicts open to the jury over the last few months, depending on which conclusions they reached. Can you just talk me through the options that they had and how they differed from one another?
Yeah, I mean, there were verdicts that the coroner, Dr. Myra Cullinan, put before them, and there was misadventure, which would have been, you know, things went wrong on the night and things could have been done better on the night. And so that was one verdict that was open to them. Another verdict of open to them was an open verdict where they couldn't establish the facts of how the deaths happened. There was the narrative verdict, which is a kind of unusual one where they sort of talk through what happened on the night without really drawing any conclusions, sort of saying, here's what happened. And then there was the unlawful killing verdict, which was, you know, highly controversial and contested. And the former manager, Eamon Bushley, did take a judicial review before the inquests opened to try and have that taken away as in one that was available to the jury. But the coroner, you know, Dr. Myra Cullinan, she ruled that it should be available. Crucially, that verdict cannot find any, it cannot name or blame or exonerate, an inquest can't do that, blame or exonerate any one person or any group of people or any organisation. But unlawful killing, she felt, had to be available to the jury, because if it was established that laws were broken and breached that contributed in a substantial way to the deaths, that that was the legal conclusion they should come to, that it would, their deaths were unlawful without blaming anyone or naming anyone.
Kitty, is this the end of the road now for these families? I mean, how important has this whole process of hearings been for the families? And do you think it's brought them closure finally?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't want to, you know, be the one who speaks for the families, but I do get the impression talking to them that, you know, having been 43 years feeling that they had been fobbed off by the state, having not been taken seriously. Like, when you look back at how they were treated, even in the immediate aftermath of the fire, like, they weren't even allowed to decide where their loved ones would be buried. They were told when the funerals would be, who the undertakers would be. In the setting up of the Keane Tribunal, which was in 1981, you know, the barristers were all paid. Bushley, because of the finding of arson, the Bushley family were able to claim damages and got £600,000 damages for malicious damages for the fire because of the finding. And 4 years later, in 1985, the family still had not got a penny of compensation. They had to fight tooth and nail to even get a bit of compensation for their. And some of the, like Martina and Mary Keegan, who were 16 and 19, their families got £7,000 each for those, you know. So, like, the demeaning way in which they were treated, and then to be told that their young ones or their friends started the fire, to criminalise them. And then to have to fight and fight to get, you know, over the years, to fight and fight and fight. And so many of the parents died along the way and siblings died along the way, to get a meaningful investigation into what happened. And I think, like, to be afforded the respect of that and to have sat, I might even get emotional even on their behalf, you know. It's huge for them that this happened, that these inquests happened. And I think the thoroughness, the meaningfulness of it, the thorough investigation has been hugely healing for them. It's the respect that they wanted from the state and the establishment. And the fact it took, you know, 43 years to get to this is it's hard to put words on it, but it's not good. But they're here finally, and they've got the result they've got now. And I think for the vast majority, that they feel that their loved ones can, that they can rest easy knowing that their loved ones were afforded the respect that they finally deserved, that they always deserved. They finally got that.
That's it for today. For extensive coverage and analysis of the Stardust verdict, subscribe. Go to irishtimes.com/subscribe. This episode was produced by Declan Conlon and me, Aideen Finnegan. In the News, we'll be back on Monday.